Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. And we're going to stimulate that mind power this morning with monsters. Yes. Well, of course, this is the week for it, right? Halloween is just a couple of days away. So why not talk about something that you're seeing broadcast all over the place in one form or another, and that is monsters. There's all these horror films, and it seems like this is a part of the human personality. And of course, Halloween relates to the Celts, and it goes back for thousands of years as a special celebration, especially with the coming and turning of fall into winter. But we have a wonderful guest today, Nick Redfern. Nick has been on my show before. He always comes up with some of the most interesting facts, whether it's UFOs or whatever he can find. It's just amazing. And he put out this book called Monster Files. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks, Donna. How are you?
I am doing wonderfully.
Good.
Nick, you always come up with some of the most, I'll use the word bizarre, information. Are you able to sleep at night when you put this stuff together?
Oh, yeah, I don't have a problem there at all. I'm one of these who, you know, I'm sort of very fascinated by the mysteries of our planet, but equally, you know, I'm able to turn off and have a life totally away from it, which is a good thing, or I probably would go crazy. But I like to sort of balance a normal life and a normal social life, you know, between writing about everything from UFOs to Bigfoot or werewolves or whatever, you know.
Well, I love the cover on this book because it has
a
Nessie with it's a 3- or 4-mast old antique sailing ship. The Nessie is overpowering the sailing ship as she rises up out of the tumultuous seas that are surrounding the two of them. I think that that is just such a powerful statement. It also reminds me of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. And I just think of so many things that have been envisioned by people, but the unique, and I'll use your word again, the bizarre, is a lot more common than we usually are aware of. We think that somebody has to be pretty far out to invent some of these stories. But the reality is, there's a lot of fact behind this. There's a whole lot of fact. So let's talk about some of these monsters. Now, one of them that you bring up is Bigfoot. That's one of your first stories, the President's Bigfoot. Now, in Tibet, it is known and has been known for centuries that there is that life form that they called, I believe they called it a Yeti. And then we call it Bigfoot, but it's been seen in different parts of the world. And the Tibetans have spoken of it for, like I said, generations, because they say it's a very different life form. And it's been around for a long, long, long time. And more reports seem to be coming out as we encroach on the wild. I'm up in the Pacific Northwest, and the stories just abound. But what's this about the President's Bigfoot? I never knew a president had. I know they have big feet, but I didn't know that this was a Bigfoot.
Well, yeah, it's one of those stranger-than-true stories that I'm sure everybody's heard of President Theodore Roosevelt, who held the position of president from 1901 to 1909. But the president was actually an avid hunter. He traveled not just the United States, but even the world on hunting expeditions. And, for example, just not long after his presidency was over, in March 1909, he actually traveled out to Africa, where he took part in a major safari there. And as someone who had sort of a keen interest in wildlife and, you know, forests and woodlands and things like that, he would often, you know, speak with fellow hunters and woodsmen and people like that, and uncovered a story that actually, in retrospect, sounds like a violent encounter with a Bigfoot, and it came from a fellow hunter named Bowman, who shared with the president his story about how several years earlier he and a colleague had been out in the woods and had this very strange experience where they felt something was watching them. You know, we all have that feeling occasionally, somebody's watching you, you know, and you kind of turn around and there they are. And that was sort of the feeling they had over the course of several days of trekking deep into the forests of the Pacific Northwest. And they described hearing and occasionally catching fleeting glimpses, particularly at night in the darkness, this huge lumbering creature. And what was interesting is that they were able to track its prints, and it seemed to walk just exclusively on two legs. Now, occasionally a bear will walk on two legs, but for the most part it walks on four. So other than the occasional bear and us, the human race, there really shouldn't be anything large wandering around the Pacific Northwest woods on 2 feet. But this creature seemed to be. And there were reports of people in the area supposedly being killed by it, and it was given sort of almost like definitive supernatural status. And Bowman and his friend went out there, and unfortunately, according to Bowman, his friend was killed by this creature by like a savage bite to the neck. Mm-hmm. And the story was shared with the president, and he actually wrote about it. A lot of people don't realize, too, that President Roosevelt was also an author. And the book in question was called The Wilderness Hunter, which was published in 1906. And he talks in there about this particular case of this killing of a hunter in the Pacific Northwest by this large, as I said, lumbering, two-feeted creature that, with hindsight, really does sound today like what we would call Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, getting into something that is reminiscent to me of an old classic called The Island of Dr. Moreau, and this is, I forget the name of the author, but the...
H.G. Wells. Yeah.
H.G. Wells, thank you. And that, to me, was done so far ahead of its time, and you bring out some information about experiments that were actually done regarding human-ape hybrids. So this is a concept that is not new. And you also have a story in here about Stalin. Of course, I think he is the worst, one of the worst human beings that's ever been on this planet.
Yeah, he was.
And the stuff that he supported. But what is this research facility that was in Paris? I think you said it was the Pasteur Institute in Kindia, French Guinea? What in the world was this all about?
Well, yeah, this is actually sort of a French part of Africa, but what happened was that there was a Russian scientist in the early part of the 20th century named Ilya Ivanov, and he was someone who was obsessed by the idea of trying to crossbreed animals with a view to try and make him like a super animal. You know, the idea being if you could cross two first-class racehorses, you know, the offspring would all be perfect racehorses as well, but it doesn't always, you know, work out like that. And one of Ivanov's particular obsessions, a very unsettling obsession, was the idea of trying to crossbreed humans with apes. Now, although we actually have a very extremely close DNA matchup with apes, for example, we're more than 90%, our DNA is almost 90%, is more than 90% identical with chimpanzee DNA. The percentage which isn't identical is like incredibly small, but it's those small differences that make us look so different to chimpanzees and act different and think differently. But in terms of DNA, we're actually not far away from them at all. As I said, it's in excess of 90% identical. And so Ivanov had this idea to try and crossbreed apes and humans. And he did this in two locations, one in French-owned land in West Africa and the other in certain portions of the former Soviet Union, where he established labs, and which were actually funded by the Soviet Academy of Sciences, as it was called back then, which was an official arm of the Soviet government. And he undertook these experiments where essentially there was nothing sort of spectacularly advanced about it. He just essentially impregnated female apes and chimpanzees with human sperm. But of course, you know, nature has its own sort of inbuilt mechanisms to try and prevent freakish offspring from being born. And the official story, at least, is that all of these experiments just ended in disaster. You know, they just totally failed. But there are a few rumors that, against all the odds, that one of the two of the experiments did work, and they sort of gave birth to freakish half-human, half-ape-like creatures that perhaps didn't live long, that were deformed and mutated, which often happens when inbreeding and outside of normal breeding occurs. And that even if some of them survive, the story is that they may have been banished to the wilds of Siberia for a fear of upsetting Stalin, you know, who was like a ruthless leader who would probably put people to death, you know, if he thought that they'd failed to, in an experiment, and we'd be besmirched like the Soviet Union. And so the story was the whole thing was buried. Now, we can't prove that any of the experiments worked, but we can prove the experiments went ahead, because some of the documents, or many of the documents related to Ivanov's experiments, have now surfaced through the old Russian archives, and several of the labs where he did these experiments have actually been identified as well. So in that sense, you know, we know the experiments went ahead, but we're still at rumor stage as to whether or not there were some sort of ape-man type creatures born and even survived, perhaps.
Yes, and there was a Lieutenant Colonel, V.S. Karapetyan, of the Soviet Army's medical service, that was witness to something that was just beyond his understanding, and he just... The story that he has is quite interesting. I won't go into it so people can decide they're going to read it themselves. Now, you talk also, and again, this is something that so often is hidden. There have been so many different reports of mutations that have come up on the East Coast up by New York. And there have been commentaries made on this. People say we don't understand what we're looking at. And they either disintegrate or it's hushed up really quickly. You have something in here about the evening of September 12, 1952. And there was an incident in Flatwoods, West Virginia. What happened?
Well, yeah, the Flatwoods story has become sort of legendary and famous within the UFO subject, but also in the field of cryptozoology, because it's which is the study of unknown animals, because it kind of straddles both areas. And on the night of one particular night in September 1952, some of the townsfolk in this little town of Flatwoods, which is still a very small town to this day, I think the population is still under 500 to this very day. But they reported seeing some sort of object streaking across the sky that seemed to crash or crash land in a hilly, wooded area outside of town. And a number of the local people raced out there to see what it was. And they reportedly encountered this huge 12-foot-tall humanoid-type figure that was kind of seemed a little bit robotic or mechanized even, had these glowing red eyes, and a head shaped like the Ace of Spades card in a deck of cards. And quite understandably, they all fled the scene in terror, ran down the hill, and when people ventured up there again later, the creature, whatever it was, had gone. And as I said, the story's become infamous within both UFO lore and monster hunting lore as well. But when I was doing the research, one of the things I uncovered was a previously classified Air Force document which talked about how in the Second World War, the British Army had created something eerily similar to the Flatwoods Monster. It was like almost like a robotic scarecrow type thing. It sounds bizarre, but the plan was to sort of release it in the vicinity of Italian villages as a means to try and convince the Italians that the devil was coming for them because they were working with the Germans. So it was like a weird psychological warfare tool to frighten the enemy. And when you look at it, the description of this British construction or contraption, it was, again, it was 12 feet tall, and it had these, they created these glowing red eyes from it, for it, I should say, out of essentially like just lenses, you know, coated red. and they added all these wires and sparks to it that would sort of create static electricity when it was seen late at night. So it looked very horrific and graphic. And that's exactly how the Flatwoods Monster was described, with these strange arcing electric sparks coming from it and these glowing eyes. So even though we can't prove it, I think there's some evidence that the Flatwoods Monster may have been sort of like a fabricated creation to try and fool people into thinking they were seeing something monstrous to determine their reaction, you know, how people would respond in circumstances involving something definitively weird and alternative. But I don't think we'll ever really know the truth of the matter, but and it certainly is one of these cases that could still go either way, but it's sort of a fascinating piece of secret military history in many respects as well.
I think in so many parts of the world there are always unique lessons, and there is one about supersized snakes. Now, they do exist.
Oh,
I
yeah.
know in Ripley's Believe It or Not, they have had research that they have found that these stories have not been made up. And there mm-hmm. was some program I saw where, and this was, I forget where this was, if it was in Guam, some tropical environment, and they had caught this snake that was 30 feet long, something like this, and it's just mind-boggling, huge. I mean, it was just monstrous. But this story in South America, in Ghana, it seems like the supersized snakes were abundant. Tell us about this.
Well, yeah, I mean, 30 feet is long enough, but in the Jurassic period, there was actually a snake known as Titanoboa, which grew to 50 feet in length and had a body like the thickness of two oil drums, you know, which is incredibly huge. And even though creatures like Titanoboa reportedly became extinct long, long ago, there are actually stories about some of these gigantic snakes surviving in some of the wilder and more jungle-fied areas of South America. And I talk about a couple of cases in the book, several from Guyana in surprisingly recent years. A friend of mine named Richard Freeman went on an expedition to Guyana in 2007 and uncovered a number of stories relative to these giant snakes and local villagers reportedly being attacked and even snatched and killed and eaten by these creatures. And of course, some of these reports were of animals of the size of like 40 feet in length, and really, you know, a 40-foot long snake with a body like an oil drum, you really wouldn't stand a chance against it. But Richard uncovered a number of stories along those lines. But for me, at least, the most fascinating one is one that surfaced in the 1950s out of Bolivia, where reportedly at the local embassy in Bolivia, the American embassy in Bolivia, there was a CIA team stationed there, which was basically responsible for, you know, keeping tabs on what was going on in Bolivia at the time. And they reportedly were actually involved in like a firefight with a giant snake, where a number of local tribespeople had been killed by this massive marauding snake, and they actually called on the Americans, you know, can you help us with it? And so a team from the local CIA station went out armed with guns and reportedly killed this creature, but after sort of a considerable battle where they, you know, literally were sort of fighting it with guns, bullets, etc., and the snake just would not go down, which is not surprising given its sort of the strength of it, the size of it, and the thickness of its skin. And so it was a fascinating story, almost like a real-life Indiana Jones, you know, of government agents traveling around to this exotic location and slaughtering this violent monster.
Well, again, fact is, I think, sometimes a lot stranger than what we might make up. Now, what I found intriguing was your chapter, The Strange Saga of a Callistic Kitty. And this is a story that when I read it, I went, unreal. You have got to be kidding. Tell us what the CIA was involved with and how much it cost.
Well, this is a program called Acoustic Kitty, which is a strange name, but it was actually the official name of of a project set up in the mid-1960s by the CIA. And a number of the Acoustic Kitty files have been now been declassified through the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. And you can find them online and find the story of how the CIA got involved as well. But basically, it was sort of like a freakish Frankenstein monster program that was actually funded to the degree of no less than $10 million, which was a lot of money back in the mid-60s, never mind today.
No kidding.
Yeah, but the whole idea of the project was to, it sounds a bit grisly, but was to insert inside the bodies of living cats sort of like radio tracking equipment, broadcasting technology, radio technology, this sort of thing. And the plan was to try and turn the cats into almost like a robo-cat type creature and have the try and train them to wander around the grounds of the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. And because they would have all this sort of tracking equipment installed in their tails and bodies, that was the plan. You know, they could, and microphones even, they could, in theory, pick up any conversations that the Russians might be making in the grounds of the embassy. And the plan was that, well, they're not going to pay any attention to a little cat walking by, you know, they're not going to care, and they won't realize that their conversations are being recorded, you know, by this sophisticated technology implanted in the cat. And it does sound straight out of something, you know, the world of science fiction, until you realize we now have the official files that have been declassified. And they talk about how the first experiment actually worked. The cat survived the surgery, had all this technology, all these wiring devices and listening devices inserted and implanted in its body, and they actually took it out to as close as they could get to the Russian embassy without revealing themselves, and kind of encouraged the cat out of the doors of the back of this van, which it did, and it actually walked across the road towards the embassy, but it got hit and killed by a taxi. So it was sort of like fate intervened, unfortunately, and eventually the project was cancelled because it was just seen as being too unfeasible in terms of they'd have to try and train the cat, it would have to be at the right place at the right time to pick up any conversations. Who could say how long they would live without sort of rejecting, you know, the body rejecting all this metal inserted inside of it. And so the whole thing was cancelled and quietly forgotten about until the document surfaced, and that's how we found out. But so it's a sort of fascinating and bizarre aspect of the CIA's spying history, if you like.
You go into the British Isles, and this has to do with the ABCs of a royal conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And the ABCs, though, are not points. It's about alien big cats. Tell us about these cats.
Well, yeah, I mean, Britain is just, you know, an island. It's barely 700 miles long, has a population of 60 million people. And there's a wide range of animals, but they're pretty much normal animals, like in the wild, like deer, hedgehogs, foxes, that kind of thing. There's nothing sort of really large and exotic, or there shouldn't be. But every year, literally going back actually centuries, not just even decades, people have reported what have become known as ABCs, and that stands for alien big cats. People reported numerous sightings of large black cats the size of, in the United States, what you consider something like a mountain lion or a black leopard, something like that. And there shouldn't be anything like that in the wilds of Britain at all, but people see them. And it's given rise to theories that perhaps they've escaped over the years from private zoos and, you know, they've mated and bred, and now we've got, you know, the descendants of the descendants of the descendants running around, which is an interesting theory. Now, I include this in the book because there's a friend of mine named John Downes who is a well-known author in the south of England. And John uncovered a very fascinating but weird story. And it relates to none other than Princess Diana. And in the mid-1980s, there were fears that Diana was going to be captured or possibly even assassinated by terrorists. And so she was placed under secret surveillance by a detachment of the British Army, which is almost like the equivalent of like a Delta Force type team over here, you know, like an elite team that could respond to a fraught situation. And even the royal family, apparently, and certainly Diana, didn't know she was being followed. But on one occasion, she was visiting a residence in a small Devonshire village. Devonshire is where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle set the Hound of the Baskervilles novel. So it's like this foggy, misty, mysterious moorland filled with these old villages that date back centuries. And Diana was actually staying at one of the houses in this little village. So this team was watching her with like nightscope equipment, or watching the house, I should say, with nightscope equipment and guns ready in case any sort of attack occurred, which he didn't. But the story related to John Downes by one of the soldiers who was actually involved and who came forward years later said that as they were watching at the house, they saw this huge black cat go prowling past the front gate. And this was sort of totally unanticipated. You know, they were ready for like terrorists or assassins, not a large black cat prowling around. And they didn't know what to do. Should they shoot it, or would that, alert everybody in the village and eventually the local media and possibly the national media to the fact that what they were really doing there? And that was a story they didn't want to get out. So everybody essentially just sat in silence and hoping the big cat would simply leave and make its way across the moorlands, which eventually it did. And, you know, there was no attempt on the cat's part to sort of savagely attack the front door of the house or anything like that. It just wandered off. But it was sort of a very strange story, and actually, ironically, led to a cover-up of the big cat sighting for fear that it would reveal the truth about the military spying or watching Diana because of these terrorist threats.
I love stories like that. All right, now you've got, I know we've got just a little bit of time, a very interesting photograph. It was taken in 1933. Thylacine is the name of a distinctively striped marsupial that seemed to be a combination of coyote, hyena, and tiger. Mm-hmm. And it grew to a length of about 6 feet, carried its young in its pouch, and it could open its mouth to an angle of 120 degrees. They lived in Australia, New Guinea, and Tasmania. And the Tasmanian tiger was the title it was given. But they think this cat is still alive.
Well, that's right. Well, actually, it isn't a cat. It's more like it's a marsupial, which is the same family to which kangaroos exist in. It's like any animal that essentially carries its young in a pouch. But it looks like a large cat, and mm-hmm. it had stripes all down its back that made it look like a tiger. But also, as you said, it has sort of coyote, dog-type qualities to it as well, and a long, ratty tail. But the most extraordinary thing is its jaw. It could almost open its jaws to the extent to which, like a snake can when it's swallowing its mm-hmm. prey, you know, almost mm-hmm. to the point where it dislocates its jaw. Now, the last official sighting of the thylacine was in the 1930s. But what's interesting is that a number of Australian governmental departments have a lot of highly credible reports on file that cover the 1930s right through to the present day of people seeing the thylacine on New Guinea and on mainland Australia in some of the larger forested areas of Australia, which sort of gives rise to the theory that possibly the thylacine didn't become extinct but just sort of retreated into the depths of the darker, bigger forests and still breeds there. And I actually think this is one of those creatures that probably will be confirmed in the next few years as having survived extinction. And it would be an incredible find if we do, you know, find a living specimen or several of them. Because, number one, it will demonstrate that if one strange thing is living in the woods, there could be others as well, like Bigfoot. But also to demonstrate that something could survive extinction for so long also sort of raises hope in some of these other scenarios where people claim to have seen creatures that have long presumed to become extinct. So, you know, in those senses, the thylacine and the search for it is an important one, but also because it just looks so weird. You know, people just really haven't probably seen anything much like the thylacine. It's sort of almost like a combination of so many different animals.
I think it's fabulous. And in keeping with the season, your book, Monster Files, makes for a fascinating read because it takes you around the world, all kinds of unique situations, and a lot of surprises inside. So this is just absolutely wonderful. Now, Nick, you have a site, a blog spot. It's nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. And this is something where people can reach you, can find out more about what you're doing. and it's Nick, REDFERNS, books, plural, .blogspot.com. Well, Nick, you have an interesting life, and you should never, ever be bored because of all the goodies that you discover and are managing to put into books for people to read. And it's documented, so much of it. That's what I think is so fabulous, these stories that come out. Thanks ever so much for being my guest today, and have a delightful Halloween.
You too, Donna. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for just a minute, and then we're going to be right back.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime, or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number if you'd like to call in and chat with me, and we do have a caller waiting right at the moment, 888-627-6008. Now, if this is your first time listening to the show, all you need to do is give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. I like your first name or initial, and of course, I'd love to know where you're calling in from. And then I'll give you my mental impressions, and after that, you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that is concerning you. Let's go to our first caller, show you how it's done on the Donna Sebo Show. Welcome, caller, to the show, first name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
This is Marie in California.
Hi, Marie. Where are you in California, north, south, east, or west?
I'm in the south.
You're in the south. Okay.
Yes.
It's gorgeous. It's beautiful down there. You usually have warmer temps. I was born and raised down in the Los Angeles area, and usually this time of the year it was so hot during the day, and then it would start to get cool in the evening. That's why people wanted to move to California, because when the temperature started getting cooler, it was nice and warm and toasty in sunny California.
Yeah.
All right, Marie, let's get down to business with you. First thing that I'm looking at is a disappointment, a personal disappointment with an individual, and I would like to say you may want to step back on this disappointment and really ask yourself why you're so disappointed. I think that you may feel that this person's action is a reflection upon you, whoever this individual is that's going to be disappointing you. Now, I would say this. Don't take it personally, because if you take this person's actions personally, you're not going to get to the root of what is really the issue that they're having to confront. So don't let your emotions blind you or your perceived understandings of what's really going on. Question and get the real facts. Then look at what those facts are. And then I think you're going to be able to make a comment to the individual that would be appropriate for it. But whatever you do, do not feel that this is a reflection on you. It is not. You are who you are. That you may have to stand up and speak out to this individual is one thing. But don't think that this is going to show up on you. It's not you at all. And don't let them get away with perhaps trying to put that perception out there. But you need to find out the facts. That's very important. If you don't find out the facts, you're going to be making assumptions that could cause you to lose sleep. So don't go there. Also, what I'm looking at is some kind of a problem with your back. And it seems to be in the lower back. And I think it's a stress indicator myself. I don't think you have an unhealthy back. I think what happens is that stress builds up in your body, and that seems to be a vulnerable spot. And when the lower back goes out, then it looks like the neck area becomes very stressed as well, which is not unusual. So there is a need for you to do some kind of an exercise on a daily basis almost, where you just do it, maybe you're just doing it 5 minutes a day, but where you're working those muscles throughout your back area and keeping them strong. You're not going to have to go and work out at the gym for 4 hours a day. That's not the requirement. Could be something so simple as learning certain yogic moves that you, or yoga moves, I should say, and then you would be able to, within maybe 10 minutes, get all of your stretching and movement done, and someone could advise you on that that's really skilled in it. But I really think this situation with your back and your neck are related. So do take care of yourself, because you're basically a pretty healthy person. Do you have a question for me?
Well, you cleared up some things for me, and I appreciate that. And, yes, I was concerned about my back. It is stress-related because I have been unemployed. I have looked, and I became employed, and then it stopped. And I'm having some issues with my landlord, and that could be about the anyhow, so I have that, but I do have a position upcoming next week. So I'm looking forward to that. So any
well, let me
on
just
that?
Make a suggestion here. You're a very talented lady, and you're always interested in learning. And I have made this suggestion to tens of thousands of people through the years because it's a very practical one. I don't know if you've ever done this, but I'd like you to do a vocational aptitude test. Now, the reason I suggest that, I don't care if you did one 10 years ago. You do it now because interests can change. But look at the strengths of interest that you have. And even though you're going into this new positioning, which I think is terrific, congratulations for your determination and persistence, but know that you are going to be able to evolve within 3 years into a business of your own making where you will work as an independent contractor. And it will be in an arena where all of your skills and expertise of the past and the present will be put to use. But you will have to go back to school, probably to a technical training school of some kind, and it will be a 6 month to a year course with additional supplemental certifications that will go on. And I think you're going to do incredibly well. You will not have to be concerned about finances, really, ever again. You got a good head on your shoulders. But that aptitude test, which is very inexpensive to take, go and check that out. Take the test. Look at your strengths and focus on those strengths. Take the top five categories in both the male and the female classification. I think you'll be surprised.
All
right. Good luck, and congratulations on your new job.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Joanne DiMaggio. Now, Joanne is doing something that is very unique. She has put together a book called Your Soul Remembers, and it involves what I would describe as an aspect of automatic writing, but it is dealing with more of what your soul memory is. It's a fascinating perspective, and I think you'll enjoy hearing her story and how it changed her life. Learning to Breathe, Sue Fries, is going to be my guest. This is a potent story and very much down to earth, and boy, I can relate to what we're going to be talking about with Sue on Wednesday. So I hope that you will join me. And then, woohoo, on Halloween, yes, ma'am, yes, sir, we're going to be talking about the alien abduction files. What more appropriate time than the day of Halloween Eve. I just think that there's so many fascinating stories. And by the way, Denise Stoner is going to be with us, and she has had personal experiences. So we're going to be talking with her. And then we're also going to be talking with Maureen Healy about Indigo Children. So we have that, and then, well, by golly, we are going to be talking about a novel by Scott Driscoll, Better You Go Home. Intrigue you? I hope so. Be sure to tell your friends and tune in, because we've got some dynamic guests. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. I came across this photograph. I just loved it. It's this exquisitely gorgeous, glamorous black cat, and someone managed to make a little witch's cap with a nice bright orange band around the bottom part of the pointed section of the hat. And here are these two little kitty ears that have white fur on the inside of them, pointing up the same direction. I mean, they just did an incredible job with this cat, seated next to pumpkins, and this is what they used as a quote. Kim's comes from William Shakespeare out of Hamlet. "'Tis now the very witching time of night." Ah, yes. And then I have this cartoon. It shows two kids are out trick-or-treating, and one is dressed up like a clown, and he has a very sad face. And this sounds so much like a kid of today. The one little child said to the other, "My research shows you get 20% more candy as a sad-faced clown." Oh, yes, yes, yes. Don't we know it? Well, today I'm going to, after the break, I wanted to share an absolutely fabulous story with you about a child that was adopted from Romania by a family here in the United States, and my goodness, the challenges they had and the blessings they got are just absolutely marvelous. So that's going to be coming after the break. But what I wanted to do was, I wanted to share a recipe with you about spicy chorizo stuffed peppers, but I don't know that I'm going to have time before the break. So instead, let's touch on a little bit of Halloween trivia. And you know, the trick-or-treating, that's absolutely, I remember as a kid, that was the deal. You had made sure you had a huge shopping bag, and the goal was to fill it. And when I was growing up in the neighborhood, the women often baked cookies and prepared all kinds of special goodies like candied apples, and they would spend hours putting all of this stuff together, and it was so much fun. And, of course, after the first year, we always knew what house to go to that had the best goodies. We always made sure we got out early, so we found that they did not run out, because we had had a year or two when that happened, and we always made sure that we tried to get out there, at least in the block that I lived on. And Samhain is the name of the Celtic New Year's festival, when human and animal sacrifices were made to the Lord of the Dead, called Saman, and the sun. Now, this was celebrated on November the 1st. Remember I said that Halloween was an ancient tradition? Well, it is. And that is where Halloween, as we know it today, evolved from. But our holiday, as we celebrate it, also is a reflection of medieval times. And a particular individual, Pope Gregory III, who in the 8th century designated November 1st as the Feast of Departed Christian Saints. Oh, yes, they had to change the image. And it is as the eve of All Hallows Day, or Hallows Een. That's right, that's how they pronounced it in the beginning, Hallows Een. That's how we got to Halloween. And, of course, all of this stuff about the witches and the black cats and the flying brooms. I mean, it's so much fun. Well, it goes way, 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 way back. And through centuries, we've just embellished it with different symbolism. But it was always a possible connection with so many different aspects of nature. And they just really, really are, this holiday is really a celebration of the changing of the seasons. It is something that now we're going to have the dark, in fact, this weekend. Don't forget, this weekend. That's right, daylight savings time, this weekend. So this is all reflective of it, and it's just so much fun. Now, there are all kinds of legends from Ireland, from England, and other places that contribute to stories about fairies and goblins and all kinds of things. But somewhere along the line, someone said, let's have a party. And then it got to the point where the children went around collecting. And it was a time for the sharing, giving of gifts, sharing of the abundance, and preparing for the cold, dark months ahead. Lots of fun here. Donna Sebo, and we're going to be taking a break when we come back. A magnificent story about a family, a small child, and the country of Romania, the miracles that followed. We'll be talking about that in just a little bit. Or give me a call at 888-627-6008. We're going to be right back.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Someone had a statement to make about children. Oh, by the way, if you wanted to give me a call, 888-627-6008. And this is how it read. Opening your heart to a child might not change the world, but for that child, the world will change. The story I'm going to share with you today is so complimentary to that statement because it's about a woman by the name of Crystal. And Crystal was in Romania. How many people would go to another country to adopt a child? Well, believe me, there are so many American families that have done that, whether that child has been in Romania, China, it doesn't make any difference. The American people are very, very big-hearted, and they love children. And she is Crystal from Charlotte, North Carolina, and she really wanted to adopt a child, and she was hearing a child's voice when she was in this orphanage, and it was this beep, 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 and she noticed quickly, she jumped out of the way, here is this little boy who is playing with a Barbie Corvette. And just was having the time of his life just running past. She saw this child, and she said to herself, I am meant to become this child's mother. Yep, that's what she said. She didn't talk to the child. All she knew is she knew that child was going to be hers. Now, she hadn't originally planned to adopt. And she looked at this five-year-old. His name was Viorel. And then, when she inquired about him, she heard his story. He was abandoned at birth, and he was abandoned because he was born with a very serious birth defect. His feet were malformed, and he had only five-inch stubs for legs. Crystal was astonished. Now, the Orwell's only hope, this was a Catholic orphanage, they said the only way that he was going to be able to make it is if he could get medical treatment in the United States and to work with creating prosthetics that would enable this child to walk. Now, at the time, Crystal was the only American to have visited and seen this child. She said, okay, that's it. I know I'm meant to help this little boy. Well, when she went in to talk to the Orel, he immediately hit his legs, and he told her, don't look. They're not beautiful. Now, can you imagine hearing a statement like that from a child? She looked at him straight in the eye, and she said, you are beautiful to me. Now, it was a very complicated process for her to go through the adoption. However, she was determined, and she had to leave. She had to come back to the United States. And little Viorel would go around to the kids because she had promised him she was going to be taking him to the United States. Well, can you imagine what it would be like among children at an orphanage telling him, nobody's going to come back for you. She left. She didn't take you. Well, that's what he was hearing all the time. He called her his mommy. He said, my mommy's coming back for me. Crystal did return. She returned because she was going to bring Viorel to the United States. Everything finally was finished. Now, this little boy, Viorel, renamed himself. He adopted the name Joey. Viorel disappeared into the record books. Joey was the new person. And when she arrived, he was thrilled. He said, I knew you were going to come back. I just knew you were going to come back. Well, now, for him, that was a big, big miracle. But there was an even bigger one that was coming. Crystal had let people know about Joey, his physical problem. She started getting donations from people who knew her, who loved her. She also started to get donations for medical services from various doctors. And it was enough where he was able to get his legs fixed, and he was thrilled because he said, I'm going to have straight legs. Now, prosthetics are not inexpensive. In fact, prosthetics for Joey, who is 5 years old, were going to be $100,000. But there was a local company, when they heard about Joey's story, they were going to make a set of prosthetics for free. He was 8 years old when this happened, and at 8 years of age, with his first set of prosthetics, he was able to do whatever he wanted to do. And he was just thrilled with his new family. And when Crystal got married, that's right, she had been a single woman at the time she adopted Joey. When she got married, he was able to walk his mom down the aisle. Now, several times a year, these prosthetics of Joey's had to be replaced. So Shriners Hospital for Children provided new ones. By the time Joey was 18 years of age, he was no longer qualified for their program. He said, well, we've got to get me some new ones. And by golly, they started letting people know they needed to raise the money for Joey's prosthetics. Money started pouring in. Children, adults of all ages were just thrilled to see what was happening with Joey. And there was a prosthetics company that offered to help. And because of all of this, Joey started, along with his mom, a nonprofit named for all the blessings that they had received and hoping to fund It's called graceslamp.org, GRACES lamp.org. You can check it out if you like. And it funds love, adoption, missions, and prosthetics. All kinds of wonderful stories they have to share. Crystal said when she went to Romania, she had hoped she could do something wonderful for someone. But she said, I'd never dreamed I'd be the one getting the greatest blessing. One person, one action can make a difference. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you are on this wonderful planet of ours. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.